Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There is actually a group of people that decides when recessions are over. Today, they said, nuh-uh, not so fast. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 12th of April today, and the Great Recession of 08, 09, and it seems 10 is still officially with us. We know that because the National Bureau of Economic Research told us so this morning. Actually, what their Business Cycle Dating Committee said was that recent speculation the recession is a thing of the past is, quote, premature. The committee is the group that officially gets to decide beginnings and ends of recessions. And after the unemployment report a week ago Friday, a lot of people, including the committee chairman, said 162,000 new jobs was a pretty clear, quoting again, sign that the recession is over. The announcement today does just seem to be the committee saying we ought not get too far ahead of ourselves. But let me ask you this. If we all knew we were in a recession before it officially started, and we all did, what difference does it make when things are mostly getting better that it hasn't officially ended yet? I'm just asking. There weren't any protests or strikes in Athens, Greece today. It's amazing what a $41 billion loan package will do for you. The European Union has finally decided it's going to have to put up cold hard cash to protect the Greek government and, by extension, the euro from default. $41 billion, as I said, is there for the taking. The IMF is offering another $20 billion if needed. One thing that's not entirely clear, though, is how more debt is going to help the Greeks with their debt problem, not to mention solving the problems that got them here in the first place. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
When you're mired in debt and default seems possible, there's nothing like a multi-billion dollar loan to lift the spirits. And so it was in Athens today. The danger of default receded, the future cost of government borrowing fell sharply. But Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight here in London was not overly impressed with the rescue package.
It's not a substitute for the hard graft, if you like, of actually getting your public finances back onto the straight and narrow. And that's the difficult one.
Greece has one of the world's biggest budget deficits, almost 13% of GDP. Gikas Hardouvelis, chief economist with Greece's second biggest bank, blames the previous government for this.
They were governing with a very slim majority, and they decided to throw money at everything, every problem. And this is what made the deficit skyrocket.
Adopting the euro 9 years ago fueled the spending spree. Greece saw its interest rates drop to German levels. Greek consumers joined in the borrowing binge. In the ensuing boom, says Hardouvelis, successive governments failed to curb the ballooning public sector and tackle the lack of competitiveness.
Simply, the euro area hid the problem. It hid it from the politicians and from people.
The politicians hid a lot too. The previous government lied about its debts. Truth be told, the Greek people may also have been deceiving themselves. The problem, says commentator John Serapalis, is the country's long history of state control. He says after only 20 years of full-blooded capitalism, the Greeks still don't get it.
We still don't understand that in a open capitalist free market economy, every debt is credited and every credit is debited. Everything has to at some point be paid for. I just don't think that's been in our culture.
He says the multi-billion dollar loan package has given the Greeks a breathing space, perhaps a year, but if they don't solve their economic problems, they could once again be staring default in the face. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The bill for the TARP got a little bit smaller this morning. That would be the Troubled Asset Relief Program, of course, also known as the bank bailout. Today, the Treasury Department said it's going to cost taxpayers $115 billion less than earlier guesses had it. A lot of banks have repaid their TARP funds with interest, so the new price tag for the bailout is just $89 billion. Of course, that's not counting a lot of the other costs. From Washington, Brett Neely has more.
Before the crisis, Americans were used to 5% unemployment. These days, 10% feels like the new normal. That gets lost in government reports about what the bailouts cost us. Martin Bailey is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and headed the Council of Economic Advisors under President Clinton.
We will never get back all that we've lost. Hopefully we will get back to full employment, but it's going to take 5 to 10 years to do that. So this crisis has been certainly devastating.
And the Treasury's report doesn't include the $400 billion lifeline for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Federal Reserve led the charge on that one. Mark Zandi is the chief economist of MoodysEconomy.com. He says you should add the rescue of the two mortgage giants in, plus the economic stimulus packages, plus automatic government payments like unemployment insurance.
You take all of that together and you come up with a number that's pretty close to $2 trillion. And, you know, I think that is more representative of what the costs are to taxpayers from this.
The Treasury arrived at the lower TARP number because of a small profit on its loans. But Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says that accounting misses a bigger point.
The government should never be an investor in private institutions. That we make a little money on the side has nothing to do with the underlying failure of that policy, crisis-driven as it was.
Now, she says, the government is stuck supporting bailed-out companies. But Martin Bailey at Brookings says, wait a minute.
And while we certainly had a terrible recession, I think it would have been even worse if we had not had the TARP.
Both Bailey and Petru say strengthening financial regulation is the only way we'll be able to avoid another crisis and more bailouts. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
The United States Postal Service, as you may have heard, is in a whole heap of trouble. It's billions of dollars in the red. It's been thinking about reducing mail delivery to 5 days a week and closing some rural post offices. Today, those plans got an important endorsement. The Government Accountability Office has been looking at the past 3 years' worth of postal finances, and it says the USPS has to do a whole lot more than just cut deliveries, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Mail volume has dropped 17% since 2007, thanks to the internet and recession. The result, says GAO, is excess capacity. The auditors recommend closing post offices, cutting deliveries, raising prices for bulk mail, and outsourcing operations. But Democratic Congressman Jose Serrano, who helps oversee the post office budget, worries about the threat to the nearly 600,000 workers in the Postal Service.
It was seen as reliable not only in work but in service. You know, either rain or sleet or snow would keep them away. And that's been part of who we are as a country, the delivery of mail 6 days a week. In this tough economy, we should not be doing anything that may create a situation where we lose more jobs.
As for the GAO's recommendation for outsourcing work, William Burris at the American Postal Workers Union says current employees are more efficient handlers of the mail than outsiders would be.
The evidence shows that outsourcing costs more money. So if they have identified financial problems for the Postal Service, outsourcing is not a way of driving those costs down.
Union contracts ban layoffs. That leaves attrition. The GAO recommends higher payoffs for employees willing to retire early. The Postal Service already offered that carrot last year. The result was 20,000 extra retirements. But that's nowhere near enough to avoid losses the post office estimates could top $200 billion over the next decade. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today was one of those days we started to work on a market story early in the morning, and then the markets didn't really do much, so we bailed. Oh, and then they closed at 18-month highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. New York, like plenty of other states, is knee-deep or worse in a fiscal crisis. Tax revenues are down, it's having trouble meeting obligations, and it's cutting services to stay solvent. Albany is also offloading any drain on its finances that it can, including, lately, its share of the budget for Governor's Island. The park off Lower Manhattan was supposed to be jointly managed by the state and New York City. Now, though, the city has stepped up to take over Albany's share, even though the Big Apple's not so well off either. Marketplace's Elise Roth explains how.
The fiscal situation today is the exact opposite of what it was in the 1970s. In those days, the state had to help the city. Now the city's helping the state. Ray Horton's a professor of political economy at Columbia's Business School. He says there's a simple reason New York City has the money when the state doesn't.
The city officials have managed the budget a lot better than state officials have managed their budget.
And how it's managed is key. New York City isn't rolling in money any more than the state is. Carol Kellerman is president of the Citizens Budget Commission, a nonprofit watchdog group. She says the city can afford to take on the state's responsibilities because it's saved and scrimped carefully.
Part of the reason we're doing relatively well is because the mayor has ordered periodically reductions across the board in all city agencies, and he's asked his commissioners to make cuts.
Mayor Bloomberg's been trying to get control of Governor's Island for years, and this is a cheap way to do it. He got a similar bargain on another park last month. But Kellerman says all this spending is making some people nervous.
We shouldn't be taking on additional expenses that the taxpayers are going to have to cover when at this point we're really cutting to the bone agencies because our tax revenues aren't keeping up with the costs.
The city plans to use private development to help pay the park's operating costs. And Columbia's Horton says in the long run anyway, new parks can help the bottom line. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The trucking industry is most unhappy with how things are going at the biggest cargo port on the West Coast. It's suing the Port of Los Angeles over a program to clean up trucks, their exhaust specifically, from thousands of short-haul trucks that move stuff in and out of the port area. The case could affect the cargo and trucking industries all over the country. Also, how much consumers have to pay for the goods that those trucks carry. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
It's a Friday morning at the Port of Los Angeles. Big diesel trucks enter the port gates to haul billions of dollars of goods from the docks to nearby rail yards and warehouses. Thousands of these short-haul trucks go in and out each day, but the air is surprisingly free of sooty fumes.
Yes, air quality from trucks has improved.
That's David Pettit at the Natural Resources Defense Council. The NRDC was instrumental in persuading the LA port to gradually ban older, dirty trucks from the port and help subsidize new ones. The two-year-old program is succeeding. It's helped reduce truck pollution here almost 80%. But L.A. infuriated the trucking industry with what it saw as a pro-labor move. It required that drivers at the L.A. port be employees of a trucking company, not independent contractors. That essentially ensured that the companies would have to buy all those shiny, clean trucks, not the drivers.
We believe it's clearly illegal.
Curtis Whalen represents the American Trucking Association. Last year, the ATA won a temporary injunction against the employee mandate. It goes to trial in federal court this month.
There is no ability by the ports or anybody else, even at the state level, to tell us how we are to conduct our business. We operate under federal laws, and we believe it's a very sham issue to basically say, in order to implement our clean air proposal, drivers have to be employees.
If the port's employee mandate provision prevails, it makes it easier for unions to recruit more truckers.
There's no question that the Teamsters would like to organize these workers.
Fred Potter is port director for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. He says labor has teamed with environmentalists to bring more regulation to port trucking. He says the two allies may have different motives, but they both want to let ports have more say in setting standards at port facilities.
The mission for these ports is to not only be an economic stimulus for the region, but to promote and create good jobs. These aren't good jobs.
Studies show that port drivers earn an average of $28,000 a year. Most of them are contractors, which trucking companies prefer. They say it gives them more flexibility when the economy turns sour, and it's brought the price of consumer goods down as well. But critics say it's also led to dirty, poorly maintained trucks at the ports because contractors can't afford the upkeep. We talked to one L.A. driver who gave only his last name. Lopez insists the burden of paying for cleaner trucks should rest on trucking companies, not drivers worried about their next paycheck.
Right now, it's bad.
Lopez says before the ATA's injunction, he got hired as an employee driver, making a salary more like $37,000 a year. The company he worked for bought new, clean trucks and paid for gas, insurance, and upkeep. But after the injunction, the firm went back to hiring contractors and transferred the cost of those clean trucks onto them. Lopez says many have to now lease the new trucks under arrangements where they end up netting only a few $100 a week.
There's people sleeping in the trucks. They're not paying rent. They're basically starving. I've seen drivers sleeping in a day cab in two seats because they can't make it.
The ATA contends many of the small trucking outfits at the ports are struggling as well and can't afford the newer trucks. They cost anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000. That's partly why L.A. would like to attract fewer but more well-heeled trucking firms to its port. It may mean less competition, but the NRDC's David Pettit argues it's the only way the port will sustain a clean trucks program long-term.
What would be better would be a business model where you have big, well-capitalized trucking companies that own the trucks, be able to maintain them and repair them and replace them when the time came, because we don't want to keep doing this, you know, every 2 or 3 years.
If the courts uphold L.A.'s employee mandate, other ports like New York and New Jersey may follow its lead. But the ATA's Curtis Whalen says they'll take the case all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, modern art and global warming.
If you didn't know it was about sea level rise, you would think it was a exhibition about restructuring the life of New York City around its harbor and recognizing that as one of the great places to be.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, it took less than a tenth of 1% to do it, but the Dow Industrials cracked 11,000 today, floated up a mere 8 points to close at 11,005. The NASDAQ also nudged up a tenth of 1%, 3 points, closed at 2457. The S&P 500 ticked up 2 points, a tenth percent, ended at 1196. Corporate earnings loomed large throughout the day, with most investors waiting to see what Alcoa would do. The aluminum giant tracked up 1.25% today ahead of its earnings report. That came out after the close. Handset maker Palm pushed up 17% on reports the company has hired advisors to help it look for a buyer. Defense contractor DynCorp shot up 48% on news that private equity firm Cerberus will buy it for $1 billion. The 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 3.8%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for February. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Investigations examines some of the causes and consequences of the financial crisis. Tomorrow's hearing is the first in a series of meetings. And the International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You've seen them at gas stations and at the gym, probably, maybe even in the elevators at work in your office building. Small television screens showing news and weather, and more often than not, a whole lot of ads. But really, how many people do you suppose are actually paying attention to those things? Nielsen, the company behind the television rating systems, well, they know. They released their first report for those little screens today, as Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports.
Advertisers want your attention, and these days they're willing to follow you just about anywhere to get it.
So they're looking for where's the best screen to reach my consumer.
Terry Brennan is Vice President of New Business Development for Nielsen. Nielsen tracked the impact of ads you see when you leave the house. But how does the company know when someone running on the treadmill is actually paying attention to what's on the screen in front of her?
We actually measure the proximity to the machines and that they were actually on the machine and watched the content. And then we asked them to recall what it was that they watched and what they remembered.
Turns out those ads you see when you're exercising sink in.
This report shows that, a quarter billion impressions are generated every month.
Bob Martin is chief marketing officer at RMG Networks. It's one of the 10 networks, including gas station TV and the hotel networks, that Nielsen included in this report. Martin says the new measurements could help his network sell more ads.
That is absolutely the hope. That is absolutely the expectation.
Brad Adgate is senior vice president of research at Horizon Media.
I think also what's very appealing about out-of-home video is that it's closer to where you're going to purchase a product or make brand decisions.
Adgate says ad sales on small screens are still a tiny fraction compared to television. But with these new measurements, companies will be more likely to seek people out when they're off the sofa. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
The city of New York is thinking long and hard about what global warming might mean for the Big Apple's future. A report the city commissioned not too long ago predicts flooding, massive pollution, and completely new shorelines in New York Harbor as the polar ice caps melts. The city is not the only group, though, taking a look at a new New York. The Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan is considering things as well. In a new exhibit, architects and artists are offering their solutions. Take, for instance, the problem of the pollution that'll happen when oil refineries are partially underwater. You could turn those refineries, or what's left of them, into a glass recycling plant, and then use the recycled glass to build an artificial reef out in the harbor. The project is called Rising Currents, Projects for New York's Waterfront. Barry Bergdahl is MoMA's curator of architecture and design. Barry, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here.
This exhibit assumes a fairly gloomy future for the city of New York, doesn't it?
It assumes a future that most scientists think is already happening, but it is a gloomy future if we just ignore it. The thing that's, I think, so fascinating about the show is that the solutions that the architects propose and offer are actually rather optimistic. Mm-hmm. If you didn't know it was about sea level rise, you would think it was a exhibition about restructuring the life of New York City around its harbor and recognizing that as one of the great places to be.
That's actually a great point. It's artists and conceptual people involved in what is essentially an infrastructure project.
Well, it's designers, so yeah. I think that there's no conflict between infrastructure and design. We tend to think that infrastructure is invisible and therefore it could be a quagmire of wires or pipes. But one of the things that they're really taking on is the notion that if we want to think about infrastructure in a creative way, design has to be at the table. But even more importantly, they're all dealing with the idea that the palette of infrastructural solutions could be much broader. We all know the hard ones that are involved with dealing with water dams and the sorts of things that have fortified cities against the sea for centuries. They're proposing what are called soft infrastructural solutions, so wetland restoration, the creation of artificial islands and barrier reefs.
Yeah, they take that soft infrastructure theme, actually, almost literally. There is, in this exhibit someplace, soft concrete on the streets, right?
That's one of the very interesting hybrid moments between hard and soft. One of the problems with streets in a city like New York that has a combination of sewage and rain runoff is that every time it rains, the streets have a tendency to turn into rivers. So they propose streets that are actually made of absorptive concrete in a mesh-like system with a complex sort of sponge-like natural underbelly so that the street actually doesn't act as an accelerator of water, but an absorber of water, and becomes a completely new kind of mechanism for dealing with the flows of water, whether it's coming from the sky or it's coming from higher tide levels.
When you sat down with the designers for this exhibition, what was your mandate to them?
I said to them, actually, I want you to do two things. I want you to come up with imaginative projects. I want them to be realistic enough that no one can dismiss the exhibition as just an exercise in sort of utopian fantasy, but I want them to be imaginative enough that no one can forget them.
One of my favorites of all the parts of this exhibit is this idea of growing oysters again in the harbor of New York in the Gowanus Canal, right?
Yes, that's the wonderful project by Kate Orff and the Scape Studio that I think many visitors think of as the most futuristic, but in many ways it's the most realistic. There are a lot of activists who have been trying to restore the oyster culture that New York was famous for when the Dutch first arrived. So Kate calls her project Back to the Future because it's an attempt to bring back a long-lost oyster culture, not so much so that we can eat them, but so that they can do the work of cleaning the water and that they form reefs so that they will begin to give some texture again to the sea floor. The sea floor of New York has become like an ice skating rink, and we need to get it back to be like a small mountain range so that it can attenuate waves.
This exhibit is, it seems to me, in large degree about what a city of the future in a different environment should be, how it ought to adapt itself.
From the beginning when we launched this project, we called it a glocal project, meaning global and local. So we wanted to study something for New York, but we did a rough estimate of the 20 largest cities in the world. 15 of them have very, very similar conditions. So this is not just about New York in the future. It's really about what can metropolitan life be like.
Barry Bergdahl is the chief curator of architecture and design at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. The exhibit at hand is called Rising Currents. Mr. Bergdahl, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is one of those where pictures really help. You can check out a photo gallery of this exhibit and comment upon them as well. Our website is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a brief sample of what's coming politically now that Congress is back in session. Cue the scary music and serious announcer.
2008.
The economy is in crisis.
158-year-old Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy.
Trillions in savings wiped out.
Remember those days? The Democratic National Committee sure does, which is why they launched a new ad today.
It could all happen again if we don't pass President Obama's plan to reform Wall Street.
So you can guess where it goes from here. Soothing announcer, calming music.
The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Yeah, so we'll see how that one goes. I don't know. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 8 points. That's less than a 10%. Hit 11,000. 11,005 at the close, actually. The NASDAQ rose 3 points. That's a 0.1%. The S&P 500 put on 2 points. Also a 0.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, you know, your average oil man doesn't necessarily work for Exxon or Shell. Meet the Wildcatters.
I'm just an old land man that hustles. Got to drill a lot of wells to find the right one.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.